Thank you. My name is Robert. I'm an alcoholic.
Robert.
I'm grateful to God and Alcoholics Anonymous for my life and my sobriety today and people like you. And Vanessa's not here, so I'll thank her when she's not. Oh, is she over there? Okay, great. Good talk. I identify with it quite a bit. Lately, I've been thinking about Alcoholics Anonymous, and it wasn't like that when I was new. But I realized more and more today about the concept of attraction, not promotion. Learn how to live life on life's terms, without a drink. To find the joy of living again. My sponsor, Bob Fisher, used to talk about that quite a bit. And he passed away, maybe 14 months ago, February, just a little over a year. And I want to thank Mark Coffey, and I know he's not here tonight, he's under the weather. But he and I have been good friends over the past 19 years, and I can still recall when he started this group. So you guys are coming up on a 21-year anniversary. Him and a handful of others. He doesn't want to take credit for it all. But really wonderful man and a dear friend, and emulates that attraction. He's happy and he's sober. And it sure wasn't like that when I first arrived to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm originally from Southern California, born and raised here, from a little town called Glendora. And my grandmother and my parents, they were good religious people. I did not come into Alcoholics Anonymous with this concept of a punishing God. My grandmother used to snap peas on the back of her porch. She lived in El Sereno, of all places. we'd be standing outside, and I was maybe 7 years old, and I said, "Grandma, does God love me?" And she says, "Oh, honey, He loves you. He loves you so much." I've never forgotten that. My dad was an alcoholic. His dad was an alcoholic. My grandmother had 13 kids, a dirt floor in Tennessee, and swept the floor. And I said, "How do you sweep a dirt floor?" My mom's from Hollywood. She went to Hollywood High and all that kind of stuff. That was something that should never have happened or mixed, but it did. And I identify with what you said, about what makes me an alcoholic is what happens to me when I drink. I love page 21, The Legal Drinking Age. It talks about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I turn into that Mr. Hyde, every time I drink. I do horrible, tragic things. Leave small children behind. In fact, in the doctor's opinion, it says the despairing wives and the blameless children. These things in the big book, man, are deep in my heart today. My grandma was one of those kind of people that wasn't going to let me not have some type of spiritual education. And she sent me to school and Bible camp and all these other kind of things. And in 1965, I was awarded a Bible for knowing the Ten Commandments by heart. Then I turned around and robbed the church. Serious. I took the PA system out of that dang place. When I went to make an amends, I didn't tell the little gang that came with me to do it. I only told on myself. For years, they would not take that amends. I told them, man, over and over again, "Look, I got to make restitution. Otherwise, I risk not being sober." Finally, one day, I walked in there and I said, and I had some $100 bills, and I just put it away for that thing, and I said, "God dang it, they're going to take my money this time, no matter what." And I walked into that church, and I spoke to the pastor there, and they proceeded to tell me that, as a matter of fact, our PA system just got robbed, and they said, "We'll take that money." I was raised, the big book talks about a mere code of morals will not fit the bill. I tried to live by those Ten Commandments, and it just wasn't going to happen. I look at often at step two, where it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Toward the end of my drinking, that last 7 years, every time I left the church in tears, I went to Trader Joe's and picked up a bottle of that vodka of the gods. Every time I went to church and cried and cried. I said, God, I know you love me. Why won't you let me? Why won't you help me? Now I was sent in here on a court card. And I still look back at it. It says, all the desperation of drowning men, what seemed at first to be a flimsy reed, turned to be the powerful and loving hand of God. That little court card sent me to you guys when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And was that my flimsy reed moment? You know, it turned out to be the powerful and loving hand of God. I often contemplate that because God saw fit to send me to you guys. That was where the power was. I couldn't tell those good people in those churches and everything else. I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop putting needles in my arms. They had nothing for me. Okay, we'll pray for you. But I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I came to believe in you. And you guys, I could tell you, I can't stop doing these things and snorting this stuff and doing these other things. And you guys had a solution for me. That was it. Now, it added into my other type of training that I have, you know, this other one that I was born, raised up in. In fact, it just made it really deep and clear to me. Anyway, so by 1969, my mom and dad broke up because he was a drunk, he was abusive. And he moved, my mom moved my three perfect sisters that don't drink and me down to South San Gabriel. I get thrown into this school district where I'm the only white person in that damn district. Serious, it's not funny. They had a talk on the campus prior to the day I arrived that they were going to have student police on the campus. Now, I have a crew cut. I fit the bill. And as soon as I walked onto that campus, I got jumped. I don't know how many damn times. I was called El Chota, the cop, you know. And all my stuff would end up on the roof of that damn building. And I said, you know what? I am never coming back to this damn school. And I didn't. I found a lot of buddies that I could hang out with, and they found ways to make money. And you know, we also ditched school a lot back in those days. I'd steal my mother's car. My mom worked two different jobs just to hold up us kids on welfare. Used to have the fire department deliver toys to us and food and all that kind of stuff. She's a hard-working woman. Breaks my heart, man. The only thing that she ever wanted to see was her son graduate school and get an education, like my sisters did. And toward the end of her life, that last 8 years, you know, I used to sit with her and show her my coin every year, and she was so happy that she had her son back, thanks to you guys, you know. And those are the kind of things, man, that just... You can't pay it enough, you know. When Mark asked me, he said to come up and speak, I said, of course, you know. Anyway, so I hung around with these gangs and these clubs for quite a while. I started drinking in 1969. By 1974, I had my first DUI, and back in those days, it was just a slap on the wrist, and that was it, you know. But these guys were making good money, and they were making money. They were making a lot. And somebody mentioned South Central. There. One of my old stomping grounds, you know. Anyway, I rode a red and white Harley Davidson. I was connected with this violent motorcycle group back in those days. And I was selling drugs down on Adams and Crenshaw, 59th and Pauldale, 109th and Main. I was pushing out this crap on the streets, man, back in those days, right on the corner at Adams and Crenshaw. You'd see me stand there. I was the only white boy out there, long blonde hair, riding a Harley Davidson. Whenever that came down the street, you know, I'd play that Peter Gabriel song, you know, that one that goes, big time, so much larger than life, cops couldn't touch me, all that kind of stuff. I had high-priced lawyers and everything else out back in those days. Boy, I remember making $3.5 million in a period of 7 years. Had the boat and the motor home and the antique cars. And the beautiful home in Culver City.
Culver City.
They were always after my butt. You know, they knew I was a drug salesman. But I wasn't selling the other kind of drugs where they could actually put a case on you. Because these were prescription back in those days. We sold a thing called Lodes, and it was glatethamine and four number four coatings. And it gave you the same effect as heroin back then. Anyway, I'd pump out 5,000 pills out there on the streets. And without a care in the world. Once I got sober, I started really thinking about how many mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles and sons and daughters never came home. Now, keep in mind, I had this deep thing that was inside me that I knew that was morally wrong, but I would say, well, they're going to get it from someplace. Why not me? That was one of my first things when I got sober here in Alcoholics Anonymous, is how many people I hurt. And I hope in some way that God could find some kind of forgiveness with those type of things that I was doing out there. Because a lot of people didn't come home. A lot of people died on those streets. Much like this thing that's going on right now with fentanyl. You know. I see it daily. My good friend Blair is back there. And he and I do panels up there at Tehachapi State Prison. We're allowed to go in there on the A yard where people are struck out. Never going to get out. The C yard, where guys have been down for 28, 30 years, they're waiting for parole to let them come out. And it's one of the biggest joys I get to do is go in those institutions. It's the second best thing to sponsorship. Mark asked me, he said, are you going to bring a 10-minute? And I said, no, both these guys are going to speak at the Friday night round table meeting. You know, my buddy Reed, he's doing 10 minutes, and my other guy, he's got 5 years, and he's doing the main talk tonight. So I can't be in two places at one time. Otherwise, I'd have drugged one of them down there, maybe two. Anyway. Yeah, with no education, in trouble with the law. Yeah, when I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no... I had $275,000 bonds against me from ever driving with a valid license. Guess what? I got a license. I blacked out of the wheel as Harley Davidson man at one point in time. And I came to in a hospital, and you were asking me about that. And I was going down La Cienega in broad daylight and just fell asleep right at the wheel of that motorcycle and woke up in the hospital 3 days later. And I used to have these beautiful white teeth back in then, those days, and I brushed my mouth across my teeth, and I said, where's my teeth? They said, you left them in a center divider. And they put me back together. This eye was hanging on his cheek. They put it back in my eye socket, and they said they didn't think I was going to make it, you know. Ironically, I still have a damn Harley Davidson to this day. Just can't get that out of my blood, I guess. Anyway. I was hanging out with these gangs in these clubs for a long time. The 80s, you know, cocaine came on. And Freebase, all that kind of stuff. It was king back in those days. And Denise was a made woman through this chapter. She had a child from a guy that was from this motorcycle club. And she was a protected woman, very protected by no gangs, no clubs could ever, you know, disrespect her. And her and I hooked up together, and we were making a lot of money, living down in Culver City, had the pool in the backyard, you know, parties that I don't remember. I was too damn paranoid. I was up on the roof at most of the time. Where's Robert? He's on the roof. He thinks people are coming after them. You know, those bad people. Anyway, shoot enough dope and come back down a little bit, you know. My beautiful, our child, my stepdaughter, but I call her my kid, Phyllis. She was a beautiful strawberry hair, blonde haired girl. And we just loved her, man. And she had this other thing going on with methamphetamine. And she was drinking Cisco. Whoop. Anyway, she's a young man. And one day she winds up down in Long Beach General, and her body just started to swell up. Her eyes turned yellow. She had jaundice, and her body couldn't process all that stuff, and her liver and everything else was shutting down. And she had a wealth of friends. They'd always be at our house. We were the cool parents on the block. Really, we were a piece of crap. Because if you were going to drink and use, we wanted you to be at our house, you know. We were just not a real good example. Anyway, she winds up in Long Beach General, and I come walking through the hospital and come to her bedside, and I'm dirty and filthy. I'm wearing a cut and greasy jeans and chain hanging from my side. And first thing she does is when she sees me, she just breaks down in tears. And she said, "I knew of all the people that would come, it would be you." Now, I came there by myself. She had this whole wealth of friends, man, that just loved her. But they weren't there when she was in the hospital. Walked in there, and I knew that she was suffering from withdrawals. And first thing she asked me, she said, "Bob," she says, "tell me about God." I reached in my pocket and handed her a syringe. She went and wheeled herself that little thing with the bag on it and everything else and shot that stuff up and laid down in that bed. And I saw her just kind of relax. And, anyway, 3 days later, we get a call that she didn't make it. She passed away in that hospital. Another thing that happened here in Alcoholics Anonymous is, I look back on it, and I've written on this, I've written a letter to God and her, that the very least I could have done was recite Psalm 23. Which is, "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not be in want. He leadeth me by the still waters and green pastures. He restores my soul. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me." I could have said those things, but they just didn't come out. Our book talks about the alcoholic life as the only normal one. It's the only way I knew how to survive. It doesn't let me off the hook of my taking responsibility for the actions I took or I did not take. I don't get away with that. One of the hardest things to do is to go back through your life and restitution. You guys would talk about those promises all the time. Well, no, a new happiness and a new freedom. Not regret the past or shut the door on it. You just suddenly realize that God was doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. It even says in there, Are these extravagant promises? We think not. You know, it says in there, they will always materialize. Always. If we work for them. I had a lot of guilt, shame, remorse. Like I told you, you know, when I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous, the first damn commitment you guys had me do was a greeter. Now, I came in, long blonde hair down to here, big brocha, and all this other stuff, and you guys wanted me to be a greeter, and I'm there on a court card, and I fought that damn court card. As a matter of fact, I was on parole at the time. I got busted in October 26, 2004 for a DUI. My parole officer informed me I had to do 7 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I turned to him and I said, look, I've served my time. I said, I don't have to do meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, you're absolutely right. I said, you don't. He said, you also never have to drive with a valid license again in your life. And I told him, true story. I said, you can take away my license, but you'll never take away my ability to drive, right? Is that arrogant? Cocky. Had 2 chips on my shoulder, not one. Anyway. You guys wanted me to be a greeter, and I said, what the hell am I supposed to greet with? I don't have any teeth. If you're new and you don't have any teeth, eventually they do grow back. After 3 damn long years, they reconstructed all this stuff, $60,000, you know, implants and all this other kind of stuff, nerve damage. I have portions of my whole mouth that was disfigured and everything else, man. And I thought that was never going to happen. All I ever wanted from you guys was to be able to, you know, there's a line that says, to look the world in the eye. I couldn't do that to you guys. I was looking down when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think anything was going to happen for me. In fact, the best thing I thought that could maybe happen for me was just to continue to be on GR, be in that little hotel on 8686 Venice Boulevard. You want to go see a place, man. That's where I came from. Little GR hotel. Maybe, you know, Section 8. I stuck around long enough to get those signatures. I said, well, what the hell, man, I'm a con man. I'm an ex-con. You guys were kind to me. You guys made me a coffee maker 1 year, and you would make a mess. And every time I'd be over there cleaning up your mess and this and that, and greeting you when I didn't want to greet you, and standing up front and doing panels in H&I with the Pacific group back then. Thank God for that group, man. It was a very active group, you know. Staying up until midnight watching somebody turn 1. Dylan, he's going to be 3. Something to be 3? Was the most amazing time in my life. I kid you not. It's when I did not have a lot of material things to take care of. And I just felt God's presence almost all the time. The most deepest memory in my sobriety. Anyway. So, now it's Denise and I are at home in that home in Culver City. Little by little, the money went, the cars went, the motorhome, the speedboat, classic cars. Last thing to go out the driveway, of course, was my Harley. And we have a little problem. And we started going up to this little place on Pontius in West LA. And we would dose in this other kind of liquid so we'd be okay. We're taking the bus. daughter's gone. She'd sit across the table from me, and tears would just stream down her face like she lost her best friend. One day I made one more little deal on the streets, had some money in my pocket. And we're taking the bus. She knows what I do with extra money. And I didn't want to see her that I had a 20. So I got in an argument with her on the corner of Pico and Sepulveda. I said, just go wait for me across the street. I said, I'll be right back. I'm going to go over here and get a cup of coffee. I walked into that donut shop and got my cup of coffee, got changed for that $20. And a little boy comes running in that coffee shop and says, Mister, Mister. And he's pointing. He's pointing in the middle of the street. And I see Denise laying in the middle of the street, and a cement truck pulled over to the right side. She crossed that street, the same street we'd been crossing for the last 7 years. Suddenly she gets hit by the cement truck. Ambulance comes, picks her up, take her up to UCLA, and they get her completely out of the woods. She's gonna make it, she's gonna be okay. I go into that little reception area, you know, afterwards, you can go see her now, that kind of thing. And I was just so glad that she was gonna be okay. And the first thing she mouthed to me, she says, I love you. So, I go home to go spend that $20, right? Like I planned on. She's gonna be okay. Later the next day, I get a call from the hospital. And they said, Mr. McWane, we need you down here. Now, I'm smart, I'm street smart. If you're calling me, something happened. And he said, sorry, we can't tell you over the phone. You got to come up here. So I go up there to that hospital and see these angels, mercy, these nurses. And they said, during the procedure, she had a broken hip that they were going to put a pin in and she was going to be okay. But they had the oxygen going into her stomach cavity instead of into her lungs. She flatlined several times. She was without oxygen for a period of 7 minutes. She had brain activity, so they were keeping her alive. And then they moved her from that facility into another one, into where she had a board and care. She had a tremendous lawsuit through this company. We weren't married. We were together 19 years. The parents stepped in, conservator of her, and now I'm broke, I'm alone, and I'm going to that bedside for a period of 5 years and holding that hand that I held, holding that woman's hand that I held for over 19 years, crossing that same street. The only thing I could do is just keep replaying this nightmare that was going on. Every minute of every day, I'm thinking about her last words to me was, I love you. Try to drink on that one. Every day when they'd prick her toe, she would respond to pain. And I'd pray, God, please don't let her be in that body. Eventually, over a period of 5 years, going into that hospital and seeing her like that, her feet atrophied, everything just started going bad. She was dressed perfectly every single day, but every day I couldn't get those words out of my head. I love you. I could not. The big book talks about there'll come a point in time where you can't see your life with liquor or without it. I could not walk into that facility without just being so wasted and seeing her like that. Anyway, so I go out and I decided to take my own life. I know how to do it. I'm a walking PDR. I know how to write Latin. I know how to steal scripts. I know it'll kill me and kill me fast. And I'd wake up in hospitals, pumped full of charcoal. Oh, we're so glad you're back. And I'd look for the handcuffs on my wrist. And I'd leave that facility. And I'd go out and try it again. And I'd try it again. At this point, there's countless vain attempts at suicide. I don't want to be here anymore. Third time I woke up in that hospital one day, and I spoke out to God as loud as I am right now. I said, God, you know I don't want to be here. Why won't you take me home? You took that good little girl. You took this person. Why am I still here? Remember that little court card? Was that it? Was that where he sent me? Did he send me to you guys? That was just the beginning. So I heard a man speak, Johnny Harris, probably many of you have heard him before. But he would talk from the podium about these things that he did and his mom crying on the other side of that glass. My mom would come up and visit me all the way from Arizona just to see me for 15 minutes. And the first thing out of my mouth, and she'd be having tears rolling down her face, seeing her son in that damn place. The first thing out of my mouth is, Mom, did you get time to put money on my books? Well, you don't think I made an amends to my mom? Those last 8 years that she was alive? Anything she wanted. My sisters used to get so pissed off at me. Bobby, quit buying Mom all this good stuff. It's just they're going to lose it in that facility that she's in. I said, I will not. I would go to Macy's and get her the beautiful gowns. And I'd sit with her in that little rec room, and we'd do coloring books together, and she'd get her nails done. I'd take her to Denny's, even though she was a diabetic. Don't worry, they'd get her back down. Still, old behavior, man. It's hard to get. It's hard to get rid of. She liked her sugar, man, you know, and God, I'd bring her sugar-free stuff, and my sister would ream me, you know, every time. Anyway, so I had nothing else going on my dance card, so I stuck around for that sixth meeting to the seventh meeting. I heard somebody speak, and I identified with his mother while he was in prison. I said, maybe this thing will work for me. Maybe. I didn't expect much out of this. And then I started doing what you guys did. Getting commitments. Greeting people at the door. Setting up the coffee. Sweeping the floor. Putting up the chairs. Little by little, my sponsor turned to me one day and he says, Robert, he said, we have to be fully self-supporting through our own contributions. He says, get a job. And I turned to him and I said, he asked me, he said, what does your resume look like? And I said, Bob, I don't have a resume. I quit school when I was 13, have no education. I'm a two-strike felon. I said, I sold drugs. And he says, great, you're a salesman. Go apply. No kidding. Just to go prove him wrong, I went ahead and applied, you know, here and there. And then finally, this one little outfit, it was called Life Alert. Remember that damn button you pushed? They said, if you could read off this little piece of paper, you know, you got the job. And sure enough, I've fallen and I can't get up. Setting up appointments for these people. Went back to Bob. Hey, Bob, I got the job. You know, you guys always had me do things, take actions that I didn't believe in and didn't want to do, you know. Little by little, that one job turned into another job. And then into another. And we had open enrollment for dental work. And when they came at me with that 60 grand, I says, well, that's never going to happen. And I don't have any credit. How's your credit? How's your credit? You've never worked. You don't have a credit. It was cash and carry, man. That's it. No bank accounts, none of that stuff. You guys had to teach me every goddamn thing, man. And I don't apologize for it, I thank you. Anyway, so one led a job to another, and eventually, magically, my teeth grew back. Of course, you heard that part. And And then I went to Superior Court to go see about this damn driver's license that I should be driving with at the time, and despite my parole officer. Anyway, I stood before the courts, and I told them about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had all these signatures from you guys, right? And I said, I just want to be legal. I don't want to, you know, do anything illegal anymore. And he looks down at me over this podium, and he looks down at me through his glasses, and he goes, I'm going to take a chance on you. He says, I'm going to waive those $275,000 bonds. He says, I don't know what you're going to do with the state of California and the Department of Motor Vehicles. And then I went into that dang place, and I didn't know this. Man, I mean, I'm not an educated guy, but he says to me, I stood before that commissioner, and he says, driving is a privilege and not a right. And he said, and you've revoked that right from ever having a valid license again. And he says, however, he says, if you go to these classes and pay for this and this and that, he said, we will consider it little by little. I remember getting that driver's license for the first time, you know. It's outlawed by a damn biker, man. And took me 6-7 years, man, to even acknowledge with the credit agencies that I was even alive. Try to do that one when you've been a blip the whole damn time. I looked at my W-2 when I started working, and I was going like, wow, I've had all this vacation time and don't even realize it, man. It's like I just had started working, and I noticed that I was contributing in there. And you guys helped me to get the credit agencies in the state of California to acknowledge that I exist, and all those kind of things. And little by little, I was pre-qualified to buy a home down in Reseda. 7 years of sobriety. I'm in a relationship at the time. And her and I bought this home. Anyway, she's working 12-hour days with BMW. And she's making a ton of money. I'm doing all right. And at Christmas time, I had 10 years of sobriety, and we're not seeing each other too much. I'd see her for maybe 30 minutes when she was awake, and then go right to sleep, and then wake up at 9. I'm out the door at 6:30 and this and that. So how's that relationship actually going to be working out after a while? Anyway, it was Christmas, and she was yelling at me from one room to another, and ensued into a little argument. And she said, get the hell out of this house. And I said, look, I'm not leaving this house. And she pulled a butcher knife on me and said, I said, get the hell out of this house. And then prior to buying this house, we actually put on our hats, the tradition hats, right? And this is where I had to learn a lot of stuff. I talk about this because it helped me tremendously. You'll hear it in meetings all the time. The traditions are to the group what the steps are to the individual. Relationship didn't work out. Quick deed of the house over there. And moved into this little place, man, and I said, well, at least you got your life. You didn't get a knife in your chest. Anyway, I was grateful. She was a little violent. I had to work out my chosen ideals, you know, one more time. Anyway, it hit me at one time about tradition five. This is when property and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. She'd come home and I'd have a group of guys in the backyard. She said, what are all these people doing here? Well, I sponsor a lot of guys. I open up my home. It's not my home, it's God's home. Can't they just not be here? This and this. We were going to have a home that was filled with recovery. Well, that was at least my idea. It didn't happen. My primary purpose was to be in that relationship and to have, you know, open up that home. Anyway, I'm sitting up there and I'm licking my wounds one more time. And then I turned to the traditions. Thank God. The current relationship I'm in is very loving. Charlene, God bless her soul. She's a member of Al-Anon, you know, because you're going to need a program with the likes of me. Anyway, my sponsor Bob was married to an Al-Anon, and he says, get a woman in Al-Anon. He said, then you'll have two people that love you more than yourself. Anyway, I turn to the traditions, and tradition one is so important to me. It's solid. It's like step one in the program, you know, in our steps. Tradition one, the fifth line on the very first page in tradition one says, without group unity, the heart of AA would cease to beat. If I don't have group unity with you, I will be heartbroken. I remember I was so damn heartbroken at that time. They said, replace that word Alcoholics Anonymous with you and her, or this person and that person. Without great reading. I saw how wonderful that we could put on a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with people who ordinarily do not mix. Do we manage to put on a meeting every time? You bet. I said, maybe these will work if I carry these into my... Oh, it's 2 minutes. Jeez. I have a lot to say about the traditions, but I won't say them tonight. I'll finish up on that same page. It says, each individual here in Alcoholics Anonymous has a right, a God-given right, to think, act, and talk as they wish without being punished or expelled. He writes two orders on this. And it's true. What do we do when some newcomer comes up here and just vomits all over the place, right? We go, keep coming back. Right? I don't recommend you do that with your wife. She's got a right to think, act, and talk as she wishes. I started really taking these concepts into my home. And since I've run out of time, the deepest one that I love is Tradition 12 in the long form. To practice a genuine humility. This to the end, our great blessings will never spoil us. Yeah. To practice a genuine humility, to place principles before personalities. Would practicing a genuine humility mean that I would be called to do things that I don't want to do? Wouldn't it? There's times where she'll ask me to do this and that. And I just say, yes, ma'am. It's a gift, ma'am. This to the end, our great blessings will never spoil me. I've been spoiled rotten. God would say, what about this? Are you happy now? You happy now? You happy now? And I just say, no. Turn it right back to me. I don't want to be that way anymore. Anyway. Well, thank you so much for allowing me to come out and speak with you tonight. I'm sorry I got stuck in my drunkalogue a little bit here. But, yeah, it's a game changer, those traditions, man. Being fully self-supporting through your own contributions. We have one ultimate authority. We don't govern. The only thing we get to govern is ourselves and our attitude towards situations. It's a gift, man. And for a buck in a basket... Man, I can't repay it. Anyway, thank you so much for allowing me to speak.